Okay, hello everyone. I think we should start. I got berated for starting a bit late the other day. Okay, so we are having panel discussions. Today is the third day of discussions. The idea is to talk about the Human Unity films that were screened the previous day and the morning of today. The idea is thus that to see how films can influence us to unite, or how films bring about human unity. And we looked at quite a few films already. We looked at the Invisible Revolution, we looked at The Revolutionary Optimists, we also looked at Di Fremente, I think the Italian film. And the films we're supposed to be discussing today is Girl Rising, which was screened yesterday evening, and also a couple of the films that were screened this morning, I think Le Semur, and also the other one about do you remember the names? Sorry?
I thought they were
on the... It's okay. But you've seen all of them, right? More or less. Okay. So today, for our panel, we have Kavita, who is one of the judges of the Human Unity films. The way things work in Auroville is that we have films by Aurovillians and made about Auroville. And for those films, for the awards, we invite judges from outside of Auroville, and Suresh is one of them. And for the Human Unity films, which comes from outside of Auroville, we choose three judges from Auroville, and Kavita happens to be one of them. So Kavita, do you want to say a few words about yourself?
I'm Kavita, born and grew up in Auroville, went abroad for some of my education. My interests are in sustainable development, and yeah, I'm very, very interested in how Auroville relates to the world and how we're building a community based on ideals of human unity and very sort of progressive ideals, but I'm interested to see how this connects to the world, because we do often say that we're a city of dawn or a city for the future, and I think this is very relevant, especially in the context of a film festival. So
talking about the films we watched yesterday, Girl Rising was an interesting film. It was a documentary styled, it was kind of between mockumentary and documentary, is what I think it was. It's a film about girls' education, you know, how in different parts of the world, how women and young girls are treated, and how it is very important to educate them. And educating women, how it affects each and every country, the way it affects the GDP, the way it affects the human dynamics, and so on. And the way this film was done is they had given each person from that particular country to shoot in that country. So it was many directors who made small pieces from each country. So there was pieces from Peru, there was pieces from Nepal, pieces from Kolkata, from Ethiopia, from other parts of Africa, and so on. So it was very, it was like a tapestry, you know, of stories woven together. So it was beautifully filmed. It was very touching, very, very effective, I felt. And I thought it was one of the best films I've seen until now.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. It was one of those films you watch and you get to know the personal stories of some very young girls from all over the world. And we tend to, in the development context, talk a lot about women's empowerment and girls' empowerment, but this movie really gave that personal touch to it. And how it was produced, the directors, like you said, were from the countries, but also the people, the authors of the stories were, I think, journalists or writers from that country as well. So they really sat down with the children to write their story, and you could sort of see that come up in the documentary rather than having somebody else from abroad write their story or something like that. So I really appreciated that.
Now, the question then rises, then, how does this film bring about human unity? But the very idea that women's empowerment is a problem all around the world, and it's not only in developing countries, but I think it's also a situation in the developed countries, even though they would like to portray themselves as being, you know, practicing equality. I don't think it happens, you know. Even if you take something as famous or as popular as tennis, for example, you know, even in the pro circuits, the women don't get paid as much as the men do, you know. So where is this equality that everybody talks about? So even though this film was concentrating on women in developing countries, but educating women in the developing countries will make a huge difference according to the documentary anyway, because between each of these stories, they were showing statistics, you know, and it was, the statistics also were done in such a way that it was very attractive. They were using a lot of imagery, a lot of signboards and so on that was changing all the time to educate us about the figures of how things would change in each country if we were able to educate the girl child. And I guess, sorry, did you want to say something?
Yeah, please.
So educating the girl child brings them up to scratch, you know, brings them up to level with the rest of the country, you know, the men in the country, and thereby we're also kind of encouraging a certain equality and maybe unity, you know. So in that sense, I feel that this film was indirectly propagating human unity. What did you think, Marco? We're talking about Girl Rising from yesterday.
Girl Rising.
Well, it's a movie that I really appreciate because we know the situation of the women everywhere in the world. And it's touching so many different situations, not always winning situations, but give hope, because we know that the women are stronger in any way than men, and they can succeed if conditions are changing. Of course, it's a long process, and I think the women, they have to take in their hands their future anywhere, everywhere. So. I love it. It's a film that I love it, and I hope to screen it again for the community, because there were not many people inside.
Did you have an opinion about how you think it fits into the theme of human unity, how it promotes human unity?
Well, as we said in other panels, when an individual wants to get the strength and the will of changing, of finding a new way of going inside and trying new way or discovering himself and herself, it's already part of human unity. I mean, human unity is not something that is coming from the sky. It's coming only from our constantly daily work on ourselves for changing, work on relations, on immediate relation in our family, but relation everywhere, relation between friends, relation between groups of work, etc., etc. So it's really a struggle for each of us. I mean, being here in Auroville, you realize that it's not enough to change place like the movie that we were discussing yesterday. It's a daily struggle to come up and to, you know, to understand that moment by moment you have to choose, you have to decide how you work with yourself and with in front of the other. So in that sense, for me, it's part of human unity.
Gautam, did you want to say something about that?
Well, I think many of our global crises today, whether were highlighted also in the movie, of human trafficking and even climate change and resource depletion and things. But it was also a lot of statistics were given on how our cultures and communities function through a sort of hierarchy, a male-dominated hierarchy, and by encouraging gender equality and the inclusion of girls and women in many discussions, that would create a huge shift in each sector of these problems. So it was nice to see that. I mean, I think it was not only bringing up the issue of gender equality in the sense of just men and women, but equality on the level of human unity ties into this global conversation very well. And it also gave figures, clear figures on what the shift could be. So I really appreciated that impact sort of perspective on humanity.
I've been in touch with a women's organization called Vimochana in Bangalore, and they've been doing a lot of work about women in gender, but fundamentally they focus on violence against women, and they've been doing public action about this. So there is situations where they all dress in black and stand in a very central place in the city, where like a traffic junction, and most people don't know why they're standing there unless you are handed over a small pamphlet stating that this is why they're standing, because one of the most important things they try to raise awareness of is the dowry deaths and domestic violence. Obviously there are other things also connected to it, female infanticide. Three things that have been very critical in our context, despite the fact that many women are educated. The violence against women have not receded or stopped. They're, unfortunately, in some places it's accelerated. One of the issues that people have consciously spoken about is violence in urban spaces, which I think was, there was an uprising and there were public protests, etc. But at the same time, laws are not in place, and people who are responsible are not being put to task or put behind bars. So with this kind of a situation, even sometimes we feel that the women who are educated have no access to the law, and they have no access to the rights of women that are very significant for them. So there has been a lot of campaigns. One of the campaigns has been public hearings. The public hearing is a kind of a symbolic hearing of a woman coming and describing the atrocities against her in public, and a panel of judges giving her a symbolic kind of a ruling. So this has been extremely popular all over the world, and it has become a very popular way of bringing the private and the public into the public realm. I think this particular organization, Vimochana, and Asian Human Rights Council have done a lot of work for this situation. And talking about an urban space like Bangalore, where violence against women is very prominent, they run a kind of a service helpline. They have a space for women to gather. They also try and connect a network with younger women who could come and work for them. So there's always another forum, which is called the Alternative Law Forum, which gives free legal advice to women in distress and stuff like that, which I think is very, very critical and important for us in society today.
It's a good thing you brought up this story, because the other film we're supposed to be discussing is a documentary called Women for Justice. I was screened this morning, and it was about a group of women in Vadodara in Gujarat who have formed like a collective where they're supported by the police and they're supported by the Justice Department, and they go and solve issues to do with violence and also to do with any problems that women have. Like, for example, in this particular documentary, the story was, one of the first stories was a woman who lost her husband, but the in-laws kicked her out. You know, not part of this family anymore, and they just kicked her out. So she was fighting to get back some of the property that she home with her husband, you know, so the women's group go and then allow her to take away the things that she needs from that particular house. And in another story, it had to do with domestic violence. The husband had senselessly beaten this woman, which was a Muslim family, and so then they had to bring him to court, and the women themselves discuss everything and convince them that this cannot happen, you know. So in the end, the wife agrees to go back with the husband, and he has to sign a contract saying that he will not beat her anymore. And not only the husband, but the whole family and the religious leaders also are called into the court. But then, even though I call it a court, it just happens outdoors, you know, next to the real court building. So there are organizations that are there by women and for women that are making a huge difference. And it was really gratifying to watch this documentary about the work that's being done by women. Did you happen to see that film also?
It's very interesting to see how. I don't know then if in other country that can be possible that a group of women can administrate justice. And so this is very interesting to see it here in India. But I have to say that anyway, the violence is not only in India, it's not only on rich or poor places. I mean, it's everywhere in the world, everywhere in each different society layer. So it's everywhere. Educated people, poor people, not educated people. So it's amazing how domestic violence, it's everywhere. So I was very it's a documentary that give you a totally different perspective how this group of women can create justice. I mean, simply by gathering together and pushing, pressuring, and of course there is behind the police that accept that and the justice also. And it would be nice to have that in different states in India. So it's really an experiment that has to be copied.
Since the beginning, I heard the word unity, human unity, what I like. But since the beginning, when I heard you speaking, I will use the word evolution. And also education. But human unity is after revolution.
Kavita, did you want to say something about that film, Women for Justice? You don't have to. Okay. All right.
Yeah, what I found really interesting was that the jury was always her peers. And so, you know, supposedly in America, it was built on this system of being judged by its peers, but it's a farce and it doesn't take place. And so I found it really interesting that in this case, there was a jury of its peers. And yeah, very good.
Thank you for following up. Okay, so the other film we're supposed to be talking about is a film called Le Semur. Is that how you say it, Tom? Semur? The Sower? Yeah. It was a Canadian documentary about this one man who spends his life sowing different vegetables and fruit and flowering plants. But not just any traditional stuff. He tries to source and save plants that are seeds that are hundreds of years old. In other words, to try and maintain diversity. I thought it was a really great documentary. I really enjoyed it thoroughly. It's beautifully filmed, very little dialogue, and just a lot of greenery and beautiful colors. Did you get to see that one?
Yes.
Did you want to say something about it?
It's another way of seeing the human unity through seeds. was very funny. The guy is very funny. It's amazing the work that he's doing. It's a crazy artist that decide to merge his personality, and he's totally happy inside of that situation. It's very, very interesting to see how well, we know the contact with nature can really change ourselves. So, but it's interesting to see this movie accepted in the our human unity contest.
Kavi, did you want to say something?
Yes. No, I remember which movie it was. we often use the phrase human unity and diversity in Orville. And then I was thinking biodiversity is also the same concept. If we don't have a diverse landscape of different types of biological but also non-living, you know, a balance of every aspect, then the unity is difficult because it's overweight by one side. And I also really enjoyed the movie. It was very lighthearted and it was focused on seeds, but it was so beautiful because there were so many colors of vegetables and seeds and flowers and just one man who had absolutely lost himself in this like maze of farming land and seeds all over his house. And it was great, yeah, I enjoyed it.
It actually reminds me of another situation, another context of Bangalore. It was a project which I was working with from my own space, Shanti Road. We discovered that there was a German horticulturist who came to India in 1900s because of the Maharaja of Baroda, who incidentally was also the patron of Sri Aurobindo in Baroda. And this gentleman came from the Kew Garden to Baroda and worked there and landscaped the gardens and the palaces of Baroda. And it so happened the Baroda Maharaja was connected to the Mysore King. So Gustav Krumbigel, that's how he's known, was sent to Mysore. He decided to go to Mysore and he settled down in Bangalore. And for 50 years, he did the same thing that this man did. He collected different seeds and plants from the tropics all over the world, got them to Bangalore, acclimatized them, and started propagating them. So he was this romantic German idealist who was imagining a kind of perpetual blossoming of spring. So even today, his legacy is alive because at a given time in Bangalore, there are four or five different trees blossoming. So the botanists call it serial blossoming because after every season, there is a new set of flowers that keep blossoming. Sometimes he also color coordinated them in such a way that in one space, you could see red, yellow, blue, and pink. So here was an artist, a horticulturist and a landscapist who did it. And that's how Bangalore is known as the Garden City.
So this particular gentleman, I didn't get his name. Did you get his name, Tom? No, there was no introduction or anything. The documentary just went straight into his work. He also didn't introduce himself. And he was also quite an artist because he was working with these white carrots. And what he was doing was he was photocopying them. And he was putting up all the carrot images on his wall. And that itself was a beautiful installation because the carrots, most of them are straight, but then there are ones that are twisted, there are three and two and all this sort of stuff. Reminded us of our film festival logo from a couple of festivals ago. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, actually, in a way, the service that he was providing also, though he worked in solitude and seclusion all by himself, at the market, you know, bringing these like-minded people together who wanted to, maybe it was just a hobby, but people who wanted to preserve these seeds, these ones that might have otherwise been forgotten, was in a kind of bringing people together.
Yeah, I would like to add that in reality, you see, here we talk about human unity, and we always say that unity in diversity. And I have to say that Auroville and mostly the artists of Auroville are very focused on this unity. But often we forget that it's the diversity that is important. I mean, for me it's very important, the diversity. It's only through the diversity that when we can create unity. Uniformity don't create any unity. By contrary, create divisions. So the diversity is really important, and it's important to understand and to let understand to our children what is the diversity and why is important the diversity.
Yes. Thank you, Marco. And I come back to the woman. I don't believe in equality between men and women. And as Marco said, the woman has to show how to find what is the woman and the man. And after, we have to cooperate.
No, I agree with you. I always believe that women are superior to men, actually.
No, I think it's not like that.
No, I'm joking.
The whole media today is constructed.
See, we actually, women also have to take the blame a little bit in what the whole situation. I'm talking about the media thing. Today, if you go to any international trade show, behind a car, you will have a woman. If you go to any Bollywood movie today, item songs, they are all responsible for all this violence against women also. So somewhere down the line, society has to see it in a wholesome way also, you know, because it is, but in the villages it is pretty bad. Women cannot access even the police. All this takes years in India, violence. But somewhere women also are responsible for a little bit, if they can, you know, control all this. Especially the violence part, you know, in the streets of Delhi and all. Indian movies are also responsible a lot for this, and the lesser said about Tamil, Kannada, Telugu, the better.
I feel the women are a lot responsible about what happened to them. Now it's up to the woman to be ours themselves and to show their power as an integrity, and to stop to do what, or to be manipulated, or to continue to be, or like to be manipulated. I will stop here.
I made this film that was sort of looking at the roles men and women play, and so I was in the village and I saw this little child, this big girl, and she had this broom that was bigger than her and she was sweeping. And so it's sort of like they're enculturated, indoctrinated into playing this role. And then so the guys don't do anything, and it's just reinforced. Because if the mother doesn't train the daughter that way, then the village says, you're not a good mother. And so you reinforce this crazy way that the women do all the work and the men don't have to do anything.
Can I just have a go at this
woman?
So this is a huge topic, but I would like to remind you of this wonderful serial by Aamir Khan, Satyameva Jayate, where he speaks about dowry deaths. And if you have a female child, they try to make you get rid of the child, or they even try to kill you. And he portrayed this family where, you would believe that they're a poor family, backward family, but the woman who pushes the daughter-in-law down the stairs to kill the female fetus was the vice principal of a leading school in New Delhi. And have you ever heard of a dowry death case where a mother-in-law is not involved? And in India they kill women because they don't bring adequate dowry. So, there are women in Bangalore who sit in the burn ward just waiting to take the testimony of a daughter-in-law who has been burnt. and rarely ever is a male involved as the person who has perpetrated the violence. It's almost always the woman, unfortunately. I wish movies cover this kind of, you know, these kind of topics, and Aamir Khan did a good job in that Satyavijaya.
Yes, as they say, sometimes women are women's worst enemies, right? Anyway, so this idea that women are also responsible to some extent, yes, I have a lot of opinions on that, and we probably could discuss this until the cows come home. But as a moderator, I don't think my opinion really matters that much. So unless Kavita, you want to say something? Okay. Any other films that we should discuss? Well, the last film screened this morning was the Jewish families that repatriated themselves. Yeah.
Of Cochin.
Yeah, they left and went back to Israel. So this documentary is about them after having gone back to Israel, what their lives were like. And it was a sweet, quaint documentary. People had sort of been living in Israel for over 40 years now after they moved back. But they still feel connected to India. They still, when they all get together, they still speak in Malayalam and cook Indian food and so on. And the next generation also, to some extent, is interested in India because their parents lived in India or they came from India. So they, whenever they have to do research for school or have to trace their family trees and so on, so the younger generation kind of has some connection to India. But they fear that as time goes on, this is all going to disappear because Jew Town or Jew Street in Cochin itself is fast disappearing. It's all shops now. It's not Jewish homes anymore. And the synagogue stopped functioning long ago. I think the synagogues don't do any religious rituals since about 40 years. Sorry, Suresh, did you want to say something?
I've been going to Kochi and working in Kochi for some time with the Biennale. And Jew Town is so integral to Kochi, you obviously know well. As the movie says, that the surviving Jews or the surviving families feel like they're in a zoo because everybody is trying to fit into their house to see how Jews look like, whether they have extra horns or tails or whatever. But it's quite tragic to see the situation and the context and how globalization and the kind of tourism that has really taken over that street. And it is other migrants who are obviously everywhere, Kashmiri dealers, who have taken over each and every home of the Jewish community. And they also are in trouble. They're moving away from the kind of violence that is there in their own state in Kashmir. And they made Cochin their home. And so the Jewish community and the culture of this place is obviously almost absent, unless you are like a tourist within your own country trying to look for Jewish culture. But this documentary and a couple of photographic documentaries of the Jewish community will be an interesting way of trying to look at it. But what is also very interesting is the kind of liberties the Jewish people were given by the Maharaja, yeah, to be there. You know, like they were given all liberties to function, practice their religion, to live their lives until the sun and moon disappear or whatever. So this was, it was such a cosmopolitan kind of context. I think this is what is very important in terms of human unity. And this cosmopolitanism is largely diminishing in urban spaces. We are being ghettoized, where in spaces like Delhi, Bangalore and Bombay, flats are given only for vegetarians. So, no, seriously, you, in case they find an eggshell in your dustbin, you're out. You know, like, so there are Jain flats and Brahmin flats. And this is how people live in cities. And this was not what it was. Like, I stay in a middle-class locality in Bangalore where we have Shia Muslims, Sunni Muslims, Christians, Anglo-Indians, all living next to each other. And I mean, this this coexistence is very, very important for us. I mean, Orwell is based on that, but even outside of a space like this, it's largely diminishing, and all people of communities and castes are being ghettoized, and it's going to have a very, very dangerous effect on the way cities are being developed. Urban spaces are going to sustain themselves as modern, cosmopolitan, etc.
Shashi, I'd like to say something about this topic.
Sure.
Kavita, I would like to share with all of you here that for a whole year, I worked in Israel as part of my projects, and I kept going there. And to surprise all of you, that the Jews were convinced I'm a Cochini or a Cochin Jew, because I'm dark, I look very Keralite, and I wore Sri Aurobindo's Star of David, which is definitely Jew, and the lotus in the middle was the menorah. So wherever I went, I was treated like a queen, and people were whispering, Kuchni, Kuchni, you know. So I kept the myth alive, because I was literally working with discrimination against non-Jews. My assignment was about the Thai people who worked there and the Palestinian workers. And somehow, you know, I took a lot of interest in the Jews and the Jew culture there. And as Suresh said, that Israel itself is an example of how not to have unity. Because if you are even a Palestinian, you're not given a citizenship. But if you're a Jew from some corner of the world, even a convert, not a part of the old, you know, genetical order, you know, you can automatically come and live in Israel. So, you know, I travel a lot. So I made it a point that wherever I go, I would go and research the Jew community as a part of my work, because I would keep going back to Israel. So you'll be surprised that I have found synagogues in Harbin, in north east of China, and you have in Tibet, and Myanmar. You know, there's a very interesting website where the surviving Jews religiously updated. Means they're so proud of their culture, you know. So I found one in Myanmar, where the last surviving Jew is looking after the synagogue. So you need to phone him. He comes and opens the key. So the last 2 years I was working in Myanmar, and I went in. Explode a lot how the Jews left the country. There's one in Calcutta. The Beni Israelis have their remnants in Maharashtra and many places. And the most interesting place I liked was Fez in Morocco, where they have a Jew quarter outside the Medina, and inside the Medina you have the Islamic quarters. So I just wanted to share with all of you that I have plenty of experiences with the Kochi Jews, because I'm one of them, supposedly.
According to this documentary, the Jewish people arrived in on the coast of Kerala, initially due to trade, and then to escape anti-Semitism. And India to open its arms and embrace them, it makes me feel proud, you know. And that was the culture that existed before, and as you said, it's slowly eroding, you know, we're all being homogenized. And as the Maharaja, the contract with the Maharaja was, they were even allowed to collect taxes.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be until, as you said, the sun and the moon. As long as the sun and the moon exist, that contract is valid. So that was the kind of open-hearted policies they used to have. And something similar is happening now, but to do with different other cultures. Now we have the Koreans, and we have the Japanese, and soon maybe the Chinese. We have a huge Korean population in Chennai, and also a huge Japanese population in Chennai, both to do with business, because you have the Samsung manufacturing plant, and then you have the Yamaha motorcycle manufacturing plant. So we get to kind of interact with them a little bit and get to know them somewhat. So that idea still exists, but in a different form, you know, like it.
There's a lot of Japanese staying in Bangalore, and there are these Japanese restaurants which are specially for them, and they serve amazing food. And one of these Japanese restaurants, which catered only to the Japanese, had a board outside saying, "Indians not allowed."
Wow.
and we had to all get together and close it.
Sorry, in Goa?
In Goa.
Yeah.
Right.
Only the Russians and Jews. You know, the signboards are not in Hindi. They're in Russian.
Oh, like that. Okay.
Yeah. I grew up in Goa, so you know, I have a special interest in this problem.
Yeah. So, anybody else want to comment on anything else?
Vivekananda says in his, you know, he was just mentioning how the Jews arrived in Kochi. Swami Vivekananda has a theory about this, and he has spoken about this in his speech in the Parliament of Religions in the US. He says actually the Jews arrived in Kochi as back as when the great temple was destroyed by Herod. He actually mentions Swami Vivekananda in one of his talks, and he gives this as an example of how India opened up its heart to, you know, and soul to anyone and taking refuge.
Yeah, I was just thinking that it's very much a conversation, or the film is an example of identity, whether it's a community identity or national identity, and people tend to hold on to these very strongly, whether they're migrant communities or not. And in Orville, being born and brought up here, and my parents and grandparents kind of saying, no, we don't want to associate with those, you know, religious backgrounds, or, you know, leaving a lot of that behind before coming here. It's difficult for a younger Orwellian to connect to those many different nationalities, which also have many beautiful, you know, ancestral knowledge and important things that we need to include in Orwell in some way. So, for example, I have this Dutch, German, little bit of Russian and Tamil background, but how do we pull into our community the positive aspects of each culture and actually encourage and highlight them? I think that's a big question for human unity as well, because rather than just leaving it behind.
May I ask you a question?
Please ask me a question.
Do you think also Aurovillian or Sri Aurobindo Ashramite is becoming another identity in the background of Pondicherry or the background of Tamil Nadu?
I think we have very strong identities already. Or maybe even stereotypes or whatever we can call that. But the richness of our cultures that we all bring here, or our parents have brought here, I think that's, yeah, we should look at that as a part of our oral identity rather than just our habits or daily routine.
I'd like to explain why I'm asking you this question.
Yeah.
You mentioned that, you know, being a young Orwellian, it's difficult to understand this stubbornness to, you know, leave your own background, and, you know, you have people now coming back to India looking for their Goan ancestry or Tamil Nadu ancestry, whatever it is. So, you know, here, as you see that, you know, many communities have actually amalgamated into a melting pot. But today I find that in the context of the stakeholders and the recent troubles that we face in ashram, that even the ashramite or the ashram people is becoming a kind of an identity which people feel are not merging with the local people, or are actually, I'm just speaking in the context of the recent events, okay, of the problems we had around the ashram building and having to block the roads. So, you know, is it something also very thought-provoking for us, a movie like this, as she's initiated a very interesting topic in the context of Orwell? Is this also becoming problematic? I don't know. I don't know whether Marco can say something about this.
A lot of the issues you talk about to do with the locals and the ashram, and to a large extent with the periphery of Orwell also, is highly political. It's the local politicians that instigate these sorts of disruptions, you know, because they have a vested interest. It's either they want to grab the land, or they want to, they always have something to gain from it. So a lot of it is highly politicized. It's not the local people. The local people stand to gain, you know, in your interactions, whether it is a cultural or economic, they know that they stand to gain. But it's the local politicians that that create these disruptions.
Yeah, that was a good experience. No, I think it's an interesting question because I do think to some extent we have over 50 years created a culture, and looking at what contributes to that, and it's many things, and in fact it's unspoken comprehensions. You can say one thing, but you think things slightly different, or you pigeonhole some people in a little bit of a different way, and then that becomes a kind of collective culture, as it were, and that does definitely create a barrier and a difference. And so I can see that, and I think a lot of times that comes from not really analyzing what we really mean by what we're saying and how that translates. Because we may say one thing, but we still have our own reactions or our own views or experience or whatever, you know. I mean, I remember, this might sound a bit crude, but when I was a kid and I was walking to school, if you missed the bus, you had to walk. Regardless, when you would pass through the village in the early 70s, you'd get stones on you. So I tried every trick of the trade. I'll go reading a book, I'll go like this, I'll look for an old man who'll help me, you know. But after a while, you'll be just like, stupid Tamil, you know. And that's the beginning of something that will have to be changed. I mean, I had other people in my classroom that I felt completely that were Tamil, that were from the village, that I didn't have that relationship with. But so there's a combination of what happens to you, what is unspoken, and all of that builds up a culture, and that can be isolating if it's not analyzed. And that's where the role of cinema comes in, where you have to, where maybe like in The Girl Rising, that made me so furious because it just seems so silly and obvious, everything that they were saying, especially for developing countries. The good thing about that movie was there was always a positive note, and all the women that they chose broke through and fought, that it wasn't just, you know, making you feel homicidal and helpless. So that was good. But culture is so many levels, it's so many different things, and if you're not constantly attentive, then these barriers build up. That's
it. Can you just say something in the context of human unity, which is the aim of art?
Well, that's exactly it. So those barriers, that for me, human unity is consciousness. Because whether it's conscious of our environment, whether it's conscious of your neighbor, where it's conscious of understanding. I had a fight with a villager the other day, and I was really furious. It was a silly thing, and regardless. And I had to really go back, and I was like, oh, okay, I've been irritated about this development here for a while, so probably on some other level, I've been having some aggression inside, even though I hadn't, and then at this moment, it sparked, and it came out like that. And then because I'd been physically assaulted, I was really upset. It took me a while to get over it. And then I suddenly realized, like, oh, okay, from her point of view, and from her culture, and from her background, and her education, an apology is even impossible, you know? So I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, I have my differences. I demand an apology. I'm not going to get it. But okay, you know, like, so I think what it is realizing where the other person is at, then you can have an affinity, and then that anger also can go, you know what I mean? So it's consciousness. That's what I think. So I think those things have to be re-examined constantly, because without thinking, just by habit, you just develop
reactions.
Some of what she was saying, but probably just to use a different word. From my personal experience background of coming from a mixed marriage, my mother was Hindu, my dad was Christian, and born in Sri Lanka, grew up in India. So I don't really have a fixed identity of who I am, or, you know, which is home. Right now, of course, I mean, you know, it is where my family lives and all that. But I think it's a question of balance, it seems to be at least. You know, it's like on one hand, if you have too much of an identity with your culture or with your nation, it's not too good, but you need to have that also. So it's like balance between having enough identity to be your own individual, but at the same time letting go of that when you need to be part of a group.
I think I can identify with that a little bit. I spent some years in Australia, and I was about 17, 18 when I left. And when I got there, I was holding on to my culture and my tradition very strongly. I just didn't want to let go, you know, so much so that I did not go to the pub, I did not have any girlfriends. And I kind of spent about 5 years. And at the end of 5 years, I came back to India, but I found that none of that that I was holding on to existed in India anymore, in my hometown, Pondicherry. So I thought, what the hell am I doing, you know? So then that allowed me to go back and free myself, you know? So now I don't see my identity as being either. I don't see my identity as either being Tamil or Indian or Australian, you know? I just see myself as a as an international soul, you know, I can fit in anywhere, you know, get along with anybody and so on. So that kind of gave me the freedom, you know, so it's like that. You hold on to an identity so strongly, I think you're limited. It doesn't free you to do the things that that allow you to be, you know, your full potential, I think. That's my opinion.
I think it's like what
you
said,
consciousness.
If you understand consciousness, most of the issues are
It's something we use in the classroom also. If a student is playing up, it's very easy to punish them. But you've got to understand where that comes from. And you need to dig a little bit deeper and deeper. And you'll find that there is usually some reason. Either they're dyslexic and they're not able to read. They don't want you to reveal that in front of the class because kids will laugh at them. So they'll disrupt the class, you know, so that they don't have to read, you know, and things like that. So it takes time to understand and go deeper and deeper. And you'll find that there is some logical reason to it, and when you address that, then everything else falls away and you can connect, you know.
Yeah, okay. We are speaking about culture, but what is exactly the culture? Because for me there are distortions in the culture. When you look at one country, doesn't matter what country, there are distortions. For me the culture is the essence, and at one point when you arrive at this essence, you have the unity, because all the cultures somewhere are the same, no? And it is distortion always, everywhere. What she said, we have to speak, to work on.
True. I mean, culture is meant to serve us, not the other way around. Yeah. So, any other points, any other opinion? Anybody else would like to speak? Leila? Gentlemen, did you want to say something? Krishna, you haven't said anything. We haven't heard your voice through the microphone all of this year. Would you like to?
Maunavrat.
Maunavrat. So, okay, maybe we will close it. But just before we go, Suresh has said that he would prefer to have some time to watch films, so he will not be present tomorrow onwards. So we would like to really thank you for being here the last three days.
Enough of me.
So can you give him a big hand, please, everybody? Thank you, Suresh. Thank you.